Welcome to today's reading of the Midland Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
Hi, this is Jack. I'm reading this Midland Reporter Telegram for Saturday, March 27th, 2021. Section A, Unemployment. Winter Storm Chills Labor Market in February, by Mel McEwen. The winter storm that put most of Texas in a deep freeze last month likely chilled labor markets as well. The Texas Workforce Commission reported Friday that unemployment rates across its 26 metropolitan statistical areas, MSAs, ticked higher in February. The Midland MSA, which includes Midland and Martin counties, reported an unemployment rate of 8.3%, up from 8.2% in January and well above the 2.3% recorded last February. Odessa's employment rate was almost 12%, up from 11.7% in January and more than 3.3% last February. Odessa came in just below the 12% reported in McAllen, Edinburgh, and Mission. Keith Phillips, Assistant Vice President and Senior Economist at Federal Reserve Bank of Dallas, said in a statement that February unemployment was likely impacted by the winter storm, which may have delayed some new businesses from opening and temporarily shut down some businesses due to storm-related damage. Willie Taylor, Chief Executive Officer of the Commission's Workforce Solutions, said in the region remains above what's considered full of employment. Oil and gas is still trying to make its way back, he told the Reporter Telegram. It's going to be a slow grinding process, he said, of the recovery in the labor market. We need to get the message out that things are turning around and encourage people to take jobs. The fact is, in the long run, unemployment benefits will run out. He said the number of residents filing unemployment insurance claims is well below the peak seen last March and April, and his office is placing people in the job market. He sees demand for electricians, welders, plumbers, medical workers, and those with commercial driver's licenses who can work as truck drivers. I encourage everyone, if they're drawing unemployment and have the time, to look at the training opportunities at the local colleges and upgrade their skills. Despite the February decline, the Dallas Fed forecast statewide job growth of 6% for the year, down from 6.5% in earlier forecasts. But as long as COVID-19 cases and hospitalizations continue to decline, job growth should continue to strengthen. Midland civilian labor force held steady at 97,123. The number of employed fell to 89,090, while the number of unemployed inched up to 8,033. Midland added 300 jobs from January to February for a non-agricultural job count of 93,300. The gains were led by a 400 job increase in the leisure and hospitality sector, followed by 200 new jobs in the professional and business service sector, and 100 additional jobs each in the trade, transportation, and utilities and other services sector. The dominant sector, mining, logging, and construction, shed 400 jobs during the month, while the education and health services sector lost 100. For the 12 months from February 2020 to February 21, Midland's civilian labor force has plunged by about 13,000, while the number of employed has fallen by about 15,500, and the number of unemployed has jumped by 5,500. Midland lost 19,800 jobs over the year, led by 11,600 jobs lost in the mining, logging, and construction sector. Trade, transportation, and utilities has shed 2,800 jobs, followed by professional and business services losing 1,800 jobs. The education and health services and other services sector have each lost 600 jobs, followed by the financial activities down 500 and the information sector down 300. The only sector to show job growth was the government sector, which added 400. Statewide, the unemployment rate inched up to 6.9 from 6.8 in January. The state also lost 27,500 non-agricultural jobs, the first decline in 10 months. Amarillo continued to report the state's lowest unemployment at 5.1%, followed by Austin, Round Rock, and College Station. The highest rate was in McAllen at 12%. More migrants brought to Midland facility after reports of issues. Community leaders have questions, including those about number of migrants currently at the converted man camp, by Caitlin Randall. More teenagers arrived at the migrant facility in Midland County this week after officials with the Human and Health Services Department previously said there were no plans to bring additional children. On Wednesday night, 21 more children were brought to the converted man camp southwest of city limits, according to Midland Mayor Patrick Payton. He said there are about 400 boys between the ages of 13 and 17 at the facility now who are primarily from Guatemala and Honduras. About 100 children have been transferred out of the facility since it opened on March 14th, but local officials haven't been briefed on what happened to them. We have no idea where they're taken. All we know is they're taken to the airport, they're placed on an airplane, and they're in the custody of the Office of Refugee Resettlement. In an email to Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas' office last Saturday, Midland County District Attorney Laura Nodoff expressed concern about the variance in the number of juveniles in reports to officials. Local leaders were first told there were 485 children at the facility, then were told the next day there were 481. With no explanation for the discrepancy. Other consistencies in the number of children reported to be at the facility after groups have been transferred out has left local officials unsure of how many minors are at the man camp. Payton said local officials were skeptical about the federal government's assurances that more teenagers would not be brought to the facility, and that skepticism was affirmed on Wednesday. HHS officials had said no additional children would be taken to the man camp after news reports raised red flags about the drinking water and a lack of case managers on site. City council members will be touring the facility in two groups on Monday and Tuesday. He hopes they'll get answers to some questions, including where workers at the facility are going within the city and county. 60 of the minors have tested positive for COVID-19, leading to concern that staff may contribute to community spread. I just want to see the facility, see what's going on, anything that we're not being told that maybe we could pay more attention to, Payton said. Experience tells Bob Fu there is a better way, by Stuart Doreen. My wife and I did not enter the U.S. Capitol. That is what China Aid founder Bob Fu told the Reporter Telegram at the end of an hour-long interview this week. Fu wanted to be clear about his actions on January 6th, the now notorious day in U.S. history. He was clear with the Reporter Telegram that those who committed violent acts inside the Capitol that day should be prosecuted to the fullest extent. He also disagreed with the characterization of the peaceful protests by hundreds of thousands on that day as riots or acts of insurrection. He told the Reporter Telegram this past week he was in Washington that day as he and his family were scheduled to tour the White House on January 7th. In Washington, he was going to take in the activities, which included hearing President Trump speak at the Ellipse. He called the atmosphere that day festival-like. He remarked that he saw large contingents of Chinese Christians in town from San Francisco. They even bought a big Chinese drum. Out among the crowd from 9 to 4, he said there wasn't any reason to think that more than 99% of those involved were there to be part of an actual insurrection. Remember, Fu was part of the Tiananmen Square incident, a series of protests and demonstrations in China in 1989. He participated in historical demonstrations. He told the Reporter Telegram that the narrative of premeditated armed rebellion doesn't fit with his experience. He commented that if just 1% of those at the rally had been there for a violent overthrow, it would have been a real disaster. A significant majority of the crowd was very peaceful, said Fu, who commented that around 4 p.m. that day, he did a media interview when a curfew was declared. Fu doesn't trust the media. He believes they will take something he says and use it to fit their own narrative. However, he commented that communications issues like he experienced in China were made worse after January. The interference with political speech, he said, has himself in a state of disbelief. How could it be in America that providers could ban comments from the President of the United States or videos in Chinese talking about the election and about the Chinese government's alleged actions to interfere in elections in America? Why the need to censor? He called the intrusion and speech suppression by big tech that in the United States less severe than what is taking place in China, but still well organized and well orchestrated. Uniform policies, ideologically driven, and the requirement that people must obey social media operations have changed. And Fu said he feels sorry that American citizens are having to go through this stage. Fu talked about China Aid having its own issues with a social ban. As part of the China Aid's bringing attention to persecution stories, Fu will post and repost stories. He talked about how Facebook invited China Aid to send a post out to more people through an advertisement. However, after China Aid followed through, Facebook banned the advertisement. Fu called it ridiculous that his organization was invited to advertise the post about religious persecution in China and then had it banned. Facebook must have hired its own propaganda department that is now watching our website, Fu commented. Lives are lives no matter the color of the skin, Fu said. When asked about the recent killings in Atlanta that brought a spotlight by some of the media about the killing of Asians. He believes describing those killings as racially motivated fits into the narrative being driven by some involved in identity politics or skin politicians. However, he also said a crime is a crime, and he asked why is there a need to divide people of different skin colors. He commented that people in China are some of the most racist people on earth, and that they call foreigners, especially Americans, the devils. He doesn't seek to justify any behavior. As he said, if there's is truly racially motivated hatred, we all have to work together to seek reconciliation and deal with it. He chooses to see life through the eyes of those like his daughter, who he says does not feel this alleged hatred toward Asians. Some people could have that motivation, said Fu of the Sinful Heart. Social media fans who fans those flames and the media could be more responsible for by being more objective than making their own narrative. Fu was surprised to hear that a migrant facility for those crossing the southern border had been opened in Midland County. He said he wouldn't be surprised if there are politics behind its opening, but that God opened the door for us to minister to those kids. He also talked about the opportunities that the news of a facility opening brings, including that churches could look inward and see if there is room in their own hearts for Spanish language ministries. After all, he said, Midland is rich in resources and their hearts are filled with compassion. The heart of Jesus is how he described it. Their care about what is happening in the world is extraordinary. Oil prices ride a roller coaster this week, by Mel McEwen. The oil price roller coaster reappeared this week with prices sinking and soaring. West Texas Intermediate on the New York Mercantile Exchange began the week inching up 13 cents before falling $3.79 Tuesday, rising $3.42 Wednesday, falling $2.62 Thursday, and rising $2.41 to close the week at $60.97 per barrel. The posted price ended the week at $57.45. Natural gas prices also drifted up and down, adding almost 5 cents Monday and losing 7 cents Tuesday. Gas prices at Henry Hub added 1.3 cents Friday to close at $2.557 per MCF, down from $2.582 on Monday. Steve Pruitt, President and Chief Executive Officer of Elevation Resources, told the Reporter-Telegram he was unruffled by the market's moves, noting the company was fully hedged at least into May when we bring on new unhedged production. At least the market is paying attention to geopolitical risk. In his Energy Pulse column, Wood Mackenzie Vice Chairman Ed Crooks noted that the blocking of the Suez Canal by the container ship Ever Given has captured the world's imagination this week. The impact on energy markets so far has been limited, he wrote, although it is more likely to become more significant the longer the ship remains stuck. Crooks pointed out that as of Wednesday, there were 16 laden crude and product tankers delayed because they couldn't pass through the canal. for crude, the Sumed pipeline in Egypt is used as an alternative to canal for flows of oil from the Middle East to Europe, so the impact is likely to remain minimal. Crude prices briefly rose in response to the news that the canal was blocked, but by Friday morning, Brent was trading at about $64 a barrel and WTI at about $61, both close to where they were when they started the week. The impact on product markets could be more significant. If the canal remains blocked, it will reduce the availability of naphtha, petrochemical feedstocks, and fuel oil from Europe and the Mediterranean in the Asia-Pacific region, supporting Asia product prices. Flows of some chemicals, such as olefins, that are imported from the Middle East to Europe could be disrupted. Lucas Schmidt, a Wood Mackenzie's principal analyst for LNG, said that in the spring shoulder season, when demand for gas is lowest, the market can probably absorb some disruption. For as long as the Ever Given remains stuck, though, it will add cost to LNG cargoes coming from the Middle East to Europe. The route through the canal takes about 15 days, but the alternative around the Cape of Good Hope takes about 24 to 25 days, an increase of about 60%. Bloomberg reported that oil price gains Friday accelerated in tandem with a broader market rally. It said oil gains on Friday came amid strengthening equities, which were added by optimism around COVID-19 vaccine distribution. Prices also found support as the dollar weakened, which raises the appeal of commodities priced in the currency. Goldman Sachs Group Inc. said crude's decline in recent weeks had overshot market fundamentals and demand should still increase sharply through the Northern Hemisphere's summer season. The stage is set for crude's rally, but the whole recovery trade got a little bit ahead of itself and oil got a little bit ahead of itself. Once we get the real demand coming back, we can start to see prices heading to $70 or $80 or even a super spike. Oil prices have come under renewed pressure recently amid softening physical demand, a strengthening dollar, and the unwinding of long positions. The increased volatility over the past 2 weeks has been felt across the markets. Combined open interest in WTI and Brent has fallen nearly 7% to the lowest since January. Refined product prices have slipped from their highs they hit after last month's deep freeze, and crude's underlying market structure weakened. Still, prices are up more than 20% this year, and there's confidence in the long-term outlook as vaccination rates climb and OPEC Plus keeps supply in check. The group meets next week to decide on its production policy for May. WTI's nearest spread is trading in a slight backwardation, pointing to tightening supplies, according to Bloomberg. Passengers drop at airport, from staff reports. The number of passengers fell 50% decline year over year in February at Midland International Airport. The city of Midland reported 22,832 passengers boarded an airplane during the month. In January, that decrease was 48.2%. During the fiscal year, passenger numbers have dropped 49%. The individual airlines reported a year-over-year decline in boarding from 42% American Eagle to 55% Southwest in February. Southwest still holds the highest share of the 22,800 passengers, leaving Midland with 40.69%. American Eagle posted a 30.45% of the passengers. The rest flew United. The February 2020 40,992 boarded one of the three airlines. Parking revenues were down 20% during the month. That was better than the 38% decline in January and the 46% drop in December. Louisa Lucille O'Neill, a loving mother, passed away on March 25th. Memorial service will be held at Heart of Worship Baptist Church in Midland on March 30th at 11 a.m. Pamela Karen Anthony of Midland passed away on March 24th. A funeral service will be held Tuesday, March 30th at 2 p.m. at Luella Garcia Pipkin Funeral Home. Patsy Lou Barton of Dallas passed away peacefully on Friday, December 25th. A private memorial service was held on January 3rd at Cypress Fairbanks Funeral Home in Houston. In lieu of flowers, the family requested expressions of sympathy be made to the charitable organization of preference. Stanley Eugene Stan Brosick of 87 of San Angelo passed away on March 24th. The rosary service will be at 6 p.m. Sunday, March 28th at Harper Funeral Home. The Nassau Christian burial will be at 10 a.m. Monday, March 29th. Burial will follow at Trinity Memorial Park, south of Big Springs. Family requests donations to be made to Meals for the Elderly in San Angelo or St. Gabriel's Hospice. Toby Hart passed away on March 19th. Graveside service will be at Tatum Cemetery in Tatum on Monday, March 29th at 11 a.m. Texas time. Arrangements are under the direction of Kirby Ratliff Funeral Home of Lovington. Wallace Claude Sparksman passed away on March 24th. A public viewing will be held Sunday, March 28th from 1 to 5 p.m. at Nellie Pickling Welsh Funeral Home. Funeral service will be at Tuesday at 11 a.m., followed by Masonic graveside services at Gribble Springs Cemetery. Wanda Sue Mason, loving mother, passed away at the age of 86 on March 24th. Funeral services will be held Monday, March 29th at 3 p.m. at Westside Church of Christ. Community burial will follow at Gaines County Cemetery. All services are under the direction of Boyer Funeral Home. Dorothy Marie Izzard, 95 of Midland, passed away March 25th. Services are pending with Nellie Pickling Welsh Funeral Home in Midland. Michael J. Clark, 33 of San Antonio, passed away on Sunday, March 21st. Viewing will be held Saturday, March 27th from 12 to 9 p.m. and Sunday, March 28th at 11 to 9 p.m. at Luella Garcia Funeral Home. A prayer service will take place Sunday evening at 6 p.m. at the funeral home. Funeral service is set for Monday, March 29th at 9:30 a.m. at Parker Heights Christian Church in Odessa. Burial will follow at Ector County Cemetery. Robert Lee Booth, 93, formerly of Midland, passed away on Saturday, March 20th in New Braunfels. A memorial service will be held at 11 a.m. at First United Methodist Church in Midland. Arrangements have been entrusted to Ellis Funeral Home.
Hi, this is Linda. I'm reading the Odessa American for Saturday, March 27th, 2021. Section A. Postmaster Prepares for New Adventure by Michael Bauer. Guadalupe Ramirez doesn't know when it will hit him that he's retiring, but he knows it will be soon. This week, the longtime postmaster, who also goes by the name Chito, retires after 36 years with the Postal Service. His last day was Friday. Ramirez began his career with the Postal Service in 1985. 10 years later, he became the postmaster in Odessa, where he remained until 2001, before taking the same position in Midland for the next 9 years. He returned to Odessa as postmaster in 2010, where he has been since. As he reflects back on his career at the post office, he says one of the biggest things that he's learned is how to treat people, whether it's his employees or his customers. I've learned to treat people better, with more dignity and respect, because without them, we're nothing, Ramirez said. Whether I'm here, or in Midland, or Chicago, or New Orleans, the bottom line is that they're still people, and without them, we can't function. Ramirez, who was born and raised in Van Horn, said one of the reasons why he's retiring is to pursue other challenges after spending over 40 years working, which included time spent serving in the military with the Marines before switching over to the Postal Service. It's time to do something else, Ramirez said. Not to take anything from the Postal Service. It's been a great career and I've loved every minute of it. But after 41 years, it's time to see what else I can do. I'm young enough to where I know that I can do something else, and see what other challenges there are. First, he plans on taking off 4 to 6 months. I have a lot of stuff that I have to do at the house. Now I have a real boss, 24/7, Ramirez said with a smile, referring to his wife, Barbara. Eventually, he says he would like to become a teacher, adding that he plans to apply at Odessa College and UTPB, as well as possibly get his certificate in safety training. These are things that I'm looking forward to, he said. For right now, I'm going to take a couple of months off to relax. My wife and I are big tailgaters, but with COVID, tailgating has been minimized. Hopefully, we'll get back to it and tailgate at Texas Tech sporting events, whether it's baseball, football, or whatever. He also plans on spending more time with his wife and family. They have 3 daughters, Belissa Vasquez, Kimberly Phillips, and Andrea Morales, 1 granddaughter, and 6 grandsons. My wife says she's become my scheduler, Ramirez said. My daughters, they all want me to go spend some time with them and with their boys when they go on vacation. My work schedule is probably already loaded with what I have to do at the house and spending time with my daughters and grandchildren. It'll be fun. I don't foresee me standing around and doing nothing any day. During his time working in the Postal Service, Ramirez has seen many changes in the industry, including technology. We came from doing everything on paper, now into technology. The hardest thing is supposedly going paperless. We haven't gone paperless as much as you think, but that's been a challenge as far as running the business. As for delivering mail, Ramirez says nothing has changed. You still need people to carry the mail and deliver it. People are still the main ingredient in the postal service industry. You have to have great people to do this job, and Odessa has one of the finest people, the finest carriers, the finest clerks. They are the finest people you could work with. There are plenty of challenges facing the entire postal industry, and with technology changing rapidly, that will continue to play a big part, according to Ramirez. When technology came in, there went our mail volume, Ramirez said. Our mail volume went down. The magazines went down. We had to compensate by cutting people and bring in more business from other avenues. Those are the things that have hurt us. While every day is always busy at all 3 of Odessa's post offices, Ramirez worked at the location on 200 North Texas. Nothing will ever top what is known as peak season, which is during the holiday months in November and December. Come right before Thanksgiving, the mail volume starts increasing tenfold easily, Ramirez said. That's one of the biggest challenges throughout the year. We have to figure out how to get all this mail delivered as timely as possible and without any mistakes. However, probably the biggest question in the industry is how to get the mail delivered each and every day with the resources that are available and the amount of volume that is present. That's the biggest challenge, Ramirez said. Do we have complaints? Yes, but we do everything we can to minimize them. It's tough because sometimes we have people on vacation or holiday or sick leave. The pandemic has also made for trying times. With the COVID situation, it's been hard, Ramirez said. Because of it, it reduces our workforce. We're not like any other organization. Our people have to be trained. We can't go hire right off the street. We have to deliver the mail with the amount of people that we have that day. We can't call for help. We are the help. That is the biggest challenge. That's one of the most rewarding things in the postal industry. There have been good times, but there have also been nightmares, too. The horrific events of the shooting from August 31st, 2019 still remain in Ramirez's head when mail carrier Mary Granados was shot to death by a gunman who then hijacked her postal minivan. That was probably one of the harshest things I've ever endured in the Postal Service, Ramirez said. I did not personally know the young lady. I just knew who she was because she worked at the other station. But there was heartfelt warmth from the employees at the other station and the employees here. She was a wonderful lady, and I met her family, and they are wonderful people. As he prepares for retirement, Ramirez has received a lot of praise from people who work with him. Working with him has been great. Customer service supervisor Barbara Ramirez, no relation, said, "We're going to miss him. We've learned a lot from him, of course. We can learn everything that he's taught us. Chief among those things they've learned has been patience, patience. With this job, with customers complaining, I know we make mistakes. We'll get a lot of complaints, and it takes a lot of patience," Barbara said. Look out for pedestrians is TxDOT message by Michael Bauer. With spring now in full force, more people are expected to be out and about, both walking and driving. The Texas Department of Transportation is increasing its message for drivers and pedestrians to watch out for each other. A recent press release from TxDOT details that state officials are warning people after a steady rise in pedestrian fatalities. The press release stated that pedestrian deaths are continuing to rise in the state, now accounting for 1 in 5 of all traffic fatalities. In 2019, traffic crashes claimed the lives of 3,150 pedestrians. To combat this, since 2015, TxDOT has spent $153 million in federal and state funding to upgrade sidewalks, curbs, and striping for pedestrian accessibility, safety, and mobility. The release stated that TxDOT awarded $116 million in grant funding to support more than 120 locally sponsored projects that provide safe routes to schools, multi-use pathways, sidewalks, and bike paths in rural and small urban areas. Public Information Officer for Odessa TxDOT, Gene Powell, said that the problems with pedestrian fatalities across the state have also been felt here in the Permian Basin. Across the state, unfortunately, it's true in the Odessa district as well, we for some reason have a rate of pedestrian fatalities that's concerning, to say the least, Powell said. We don't want people to get hurt in any way. It's really important because pedestrians aren't protected at all. They don't have seat belts. They don't have airbags. They're at the mercy of other vehicles, and that's not their fault. Powell said in 2019 in the 12-county Odessa TxDOT district, there were 84 crashes involving pedestrians and 12 fatalities and 26 serious injuries. Those were the last official stats that they have, Powell said. In 2020, unofficially, we had at least 9 more fatalities, but that hasn't officially been compiled yet. That's for this district. In order to reduce that number, Powell and everyone at TxDOT is trying to spread the message to keep pedestrians safe, and that there are several ways to do that. One of the ways is for pedestrians to not be on their cell phones or any games while walking. It's the same message that we have for distracted drivers, Powell said. It can be very dangerous. Powell added that being on the phone or any other distraction can put pedestrians at risk when crossing an intersection. The best message for pedestrians is don't be on your phone while walking on the roadway, Powell said. If someone were to step out into the intersection while you're on your phone, you're at risk. Whether it's being on the phone or listening to music, try really hard to not be distracted while you're walking. Another safety tip is for pedestrians to make eye contact with drivers before crossing and to not assume drivers automatically see them. In addition to obeying all traffic and crosswalk signals, as well as using the sidewalks, Powell encouraged pedestrians to walk against traffic, off to the side, if they must walk on the street. If you're walking in the same direction as traffic, it might be harder to notice, so if you face traffic while you walk, it's easier to see traffic coming, Powell said. Walking out in the middle of the block is something that is unexpected for motorists. Powell stressed as he urges more people to cross at a designated crosswalk. It's more dangerous if you're trying to cross in the middle of the block, Powell said. It's a lot more dangerous if you're 35 or 50 feet from an intersection. Vehicles can't see you because you're blocked by other vehicles, and that's trouble waiting to happen. Only cross at controlled intersections. Drivers are advised to always yield the right-of-way to pedestrians when turning, as well as stop for pedestrians at all crosswalks. In addition, drivers are urged to be cautious when passing stopped buses or other vehicles and to obey the speed limit and put their phones away. With COVID restrictions being lifted across the state, it's unclear how much increased vehicle and pedestrian traffic will be expected, especially in the Midland-Odessa area. We don't have any empirical data to tell us that, Powell said. Logic tells us that with some of the restrictions lifted, more people will be comfortable with getting out. We've already seen an increase in foot traffic. The more people on the road, whether it's walking or driving, the more chance for conflicts, and motorists have a part in this too. They have to be constantly aware of pedestrians and areas where there are pedestrians. Pedestrians are their own best way to be protected, and that's by being vigilant and paying attention to what's around them. TxDOT's pedestrian safety campaign is a key component of the hashtag EndTheStreetTx social media and word-of-mouth campaign that encourages drivers to make safer choices while behind the wheel, such as wearing a seatbelt, driving the speed limit, never texting and driving, and never driving under the influence of alcohol or other drugs. November 7th, 2000 was the last deathless day on Texas roadways.
Hello, this is Michael, continuing to read from the Odessa American, published Saturday, March 27th, 2021. From the front page. Author Larry McMurtry dies at 84. Treasured Texas writer won Pulitzer Prize for Lonesome Dove. The Associated Press, Dallas. Larry McMurtry, the prolific and popular author who took readers back to the old American West in his Pulitzer Prize-winning Lonesome Dove and returned them to modern-day landscapes in works such as his emotional tale of a mother-daughter relationship in Terms of Endearment, has died. He was 84. McMurtry died Thursday night of heart failure, according to a family statement issued through a publicist on Friday. The statement did not say where he died, but noted that he'll be buried in his cherished home state of Texas. McMurtry, who had in his later years split his time between small Texas hometown of Archer City and Tucson, Arizona, wrote dozens of books, including novels, biographies, and essay collections. He simultaneously worked as a bookseller and screenwriter, co-writing the Oscar-winning script for the movie Brokeback Mountain. Several of McMurtry's books became feature films, including the Oscar winners The Last Picture Show and Terms of Endearment. His epic 1986 Pulitzer winner, Lonesome Dove, about a cattle drive from Texas across the Great Plains in the 1870s, was made into a TV miniseries that starred Robert Duvall, who has often cited the project as a personal favorite and likened his role as a Texas Ranger, retired Texas Ranger, Augustus McCrae, to acting in Hamlet. Lonesome Dove was an effort to kind of demythologize the myth of the Old West, McMurtry told the Associated Press in a 2014 interview. But he added, "They're going to twist it into something romantic, no matter what you do." The Last Picture Show, his third novel, became a classic with its coming-of-age story set in a small Texas town. He and director Peter Bogdanovich were nominated for an Academy Award for their script for the movie, filmed in Archer City, located about 140 miles northwest of Dallas. The film adaptation of Terms of Endearment, released in 1983, was written and directed by James L. Brooks and received Oscars for Best Picture, Director, and Screenplay, with awards for star Shirley MacLaine and supporting actor Jack Nicholson. "Sitting here thinking of the greatness of Larry McMurtry," Brooks tweeted Friday, "among the best writers ever. I remember when he sent me on my way to adapt Terms. his refusal to let me hold him in awe, and the fact that he was personally working the cash register of his rare bookstore as he did so. McMurtry was born on June 3, 1936, into a family of ranchers. McMurtry attended what is now the University of North Texas in Denton and Rice University in Houston, and was a member of Stanford University's Stegner Writing Fellowship. He wrote his first novel, Horsemen Pass By, at the age of 25 in 1961. It was made into the movie HUD, starring Paul Newman, that came out 2 years later. McMurtry opened his first used and rare bookstore in 1971 in Washington, D.C., and later opened other stores in Houston, Dallas, and Tucson. In the mid-1980s, lured by cheap real estate, he opened his booked-up store in Archer City. Eventually, the store in Archer City was the only one remaining. He downsized the store, both in volume and storefronts, in an effort dubbed the last book sale, but retained about 200,000 volumes. He had about 28,000 books in his nearby home in Archer City. "I'm very attached to the books. I need them. I need to be among them," he told the AP in 2014. McMurtry's writing collaboration with Diana Ossana began after she helped him get out of a slump following quadruple bypass heart surgery in 1991. They won the Academy Award for their screenplay for the 2005 movie Brokeback Mountain, based on an Annie Proulx short story about two cowboys who fall in love. His most recent novel, The Last Kind Words Saloon, came out in 2014. He told the Associated Press in 1994 that his life throughout the 1980s had been peripatetic, traveling between his bookstores across the country and a home in Los Angeles. Then the surgery forced him to stop moving. "It just so happened that I stopped at Diana's kitchen table," he said. The two, both divorced, had met at a Tucson catfish restaurant and struck up a friendship. After the surgery, McMurtry spent his time sleeping in Osana's guest room, writing Streets of Laredo on a typewriter in her kitchen, or staring out the window. She helped edit Streets of Laredo and then began encouraging him to accept screenwriting offers. "I was getting lots of offers from the movies then. I was very popular, but I didn't feel confident. I'd had real serious heart problems. I got a lot of offers, and I think that she just got tired of me turning them down," he said. When the offer came in for a script on the Depression-era bank robber Pretty Boy Floyd, Ossana and McMurtry tackled it together and then wrote the novel Pretty Boy Floyd. After that, they collaborated on dozens of screenplays. He married Joe Ballard in 1959, and 3 years later, the couple had a son, singer-songwriter James McMurtry. In 1966, they divorced. In 2011, he got married for a second time to Norma Faye Kesey, the widow of longtime friend Ken Kesey, author of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. They held their marriage ceremony in the Archer City bookstore. The statement from McMurtry's family said that he died surrounding by loved ones, including Ossana, his wife, his son, his grandson Curtis, and his goddaughter, Sarah Ossana. He is also survived by his sisters, Sue and Judy, and a brother, Charlie. The late Don Graham, a professor of English and American literature at the University of Texas in Austin, who died in 2019, called McMurtry preeminently a storyteller in a 2014 interview with the AP. "He's a great creator of characters and dialogue. That's one of the reasons he's had so much success in Hollywood." End of text for this news story. Here is a programming note for Recording Library of West Texas Radio listeners. For the next 2 weeks, on our program, Texas Monthly Archives, we will be reading articles about Larry McMurtry, including recent articles that have been written after he passed away and earlier articles that have been written in the past several decades, and one feature article that was written by Larry McMurtry himself. Texas Monthly Archives airs Thursday nights at 7, Sunday afternoons at 2, and Monday mornings at 1. Again, for this week and for next week, The next two episodes of Texas Monthly Archives will be featured articles by and about Larry McMurtry.
Quick hit. Winter storm damage assistance. Due to a great response from the community in reporting winter storm damage, FEMA has approved Ector County eligible to receive disaster assistance. Ector County renters, homeowners, small businesses, immigrant families with U.S.-born children in the home surrounding counties are strongly encouraged to register through April 20th. All are encouraged to register, even if they believe there is no damage, as damage may be discovered later. This is not a substitute for losses covered by home insurance. Eligibility status will be determined after the case review. To register or for more information, call 800-621-FEMA. Visit www.disasterassistance.gov or the FEMA app. Man sentenced after fatal shooting. A 47-year-old man was sentenced to 30 years in prison after he pleaded guilty to fatally shooting another man in South Odessa, court records show. Marcus Dwayne McDavid pleaded guilty to murder, a first-degree felony, and was sentenced to 30 years in prison. The charges of unlawful possession of a firearm by a felon, third-degree felony, and assault with previous conviction, family violence, third-degree felony, were dismissed, jail records show. Judge Den Whalen of the 70th District approved the deal, while Jason Leach served as the court-appointed attorney. The fatal shooting was reported at 9:05 p.m. July 28th as police responded to a gunshot victim in the 900 block of Snyder Street, an OPD press release stated. Officers made contact with 32-year-old Odessan Jonathan Smith, who had a gunshot wound to the head. Smith was transported to a local hospital and later pronounced deceased by medical personnel. Investigation reportedly showed McDavid shot the 32-year-old man in the head. Officers located McDavid in a backyard in the 900 block of Snyder Street. Local news roundup. Police searching for men involved in home burglary. The Odessa Police Department is looking for two men involved in a home burglary where multiple firearms were stolen. The reported burglary happened at 6:15 a.m. February 7th in the 3000 block of Bainbridge Drive, an OPD press release stated. Police have released a photo of the two men that can be seen at tinyurl.com/294F93RS. Anyone with information about the burglary is asked to contact Detective Jay Campbell at 432-335-3328 or Odessa Crime Stoppers at 432-333-TIPS and reference case number 21-0002196. Police looking for man involved in theft at electronics store. The Odessa Police Department is searching for a man who reportedly stole a computer from an electronics store. The reported theft happened January 27th at the Best Buy, 6301 East Highway 191, an OPD press release stated. Investigation reportedly showed a man took a touchscreen all-in-one computer that is worth $950 and exited the store without making any attempt to pay. OPD has released a photo of the man that can be seen at tinyurl.com/E2UV7KH4. Anyone with information about the theft is asked to contact Detective Jay Campbell at 432-335-3328 or Odessa Crime Stoppers at 432-333-TIPS and reference case number 21-0001465. Man charged with armed robbery of pickup. A 40-year-old man was arrested after he reportedly robbed a man for his pickup at gunpoint. William Bright was charged with aggravated robbery with a deadly weapon, first-degree felony, evading arrest, Class A misdemeanor, and false identification, Class A misdemeanor. He was also charged with going off bond for failure to comply, as he is required to annually register as a sex offender, a third-degree felony. Officers were dispatched at 4:06 p.m. March 24th to the 700 block of Ambergy Avenue in reference to an unauthorized use of a vehicle, an OPD probable cause affidavit stated. The complainant, identified as Jorge Ochoa, reportedly told officers that his white 2013 Ford F-250 had been stolen at gunpoint. The pickup was found at the intersection of West 1st Street and Dotsie. Officers found Bright at the intersection of 4th and Golder, wearing the brown backpack and a blue tank top that he was seen wearing in camera footage. When officers reportedly attempted to make contact with Bright, he took off running from the uniformed officers. Officers caught Bright in the west alley of the 600 block of Bernice Avenue. When officers attempted to ID Bright, he gave the name of Will Bright with the age of 32, the affidavit stated. Bright was reportedly read his Miranda rights and agreed to speak with officers. He stated that he ran from the officers because he knew he had a warrant. Bright was arrested, charged, and transported to the Ector County Law Enforcement Center. He has four bonds totaling $136,000 and was still in custody as of Friday afternoon, jail records show. Obituary for Saturday, March 27th. Michael J. Clark, San Antonio. Michael J. Clark, 33, was born October 27th, 1987, in Odessa. He moved to Dallas and then to San Antonio, where he unexpectedly passed away Sunday, March 21st. Michael is preceded in death by his grandparents, Paul and Janice Clark, and Francisco and Dominga Sanchez. He is survived by his mother, Donna Sanchez of Odessa, father Johnny Clark Sr. and wife Meredith of Garland, brother Johnny Clark Jr. and wife Rebecca of Dallas, brother Brian Clark and wife Jessica of Richland Hills, sister Marcia Clark of Garland, sister Jennifer Valadez and husband Chris of Spring, nieces and a nephew, and many cousins and aunts and uncles. Visitations will be held Saturday, March 27th from 12 noon to 9 p.m. and Sunday, March 28th from 11 a.m. to 9 p.m. at Llewellyn Garcia Pipkin Funeral Home in Midland. A prayer service will be held Sunday, March 28th at 6 p.m. at Llewellyn Garcia Pipkin Chapel. Funeral services will be held Monday, March 29th at 9:30 a.m. at Parker Heights Christian Church in Odessa, with Pastor Mark Bristow officiating. Burial will follow at the Ector County Cemetery. In lieu of flowers, donations can be sent to support Michael's passion for missionary work in Israel at www.gf.me/u/ZNT3WX. Family messages and condolences may be emailed to pipkin@nts-online.net or on the web at www.llewellyngarciapipkinfh.com. Death notice. Natasha Lee Wise. Natasha Lee Wise, 40, of Midland, died Tuesday, March 23rd. Services will be scheduled at a later date. Arrangements are by American Heritage Funeral Home of Midland.
We've been reading from the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. Please stay tuned for the weather, followed by the second hour's reading of the newspapers.